Hi.
Hello.
Welcome back to Old Millennials, a mini episode where we take a slightly shorter dive into an also increasingly shallow amount of topics. I am one of your hosts, Margot Poupard.
And I am your other host, Emily Bejean.
And today, for our little mini, Emily and I are going to review, talk about, I don't know, process out loud the HBO Max documentary Woodstock 99, Peace, Love, and Rage. If you can ignore the fact that it's produced by Bill Simmons, I think it's worth a watch. I had a good time. Yeah. I know we both watched this independently without the intention of recording anything about it, at least not initially. It wasn't until you and I started talking about the doc that we're like, oh, mini episode idea.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. Like, it was just like, oh, we'll definitely watch this because we heard about this series coming out on HBO Max with all these Bill Simmons produced documentaries. But yeah, as soon as we started watching, I think I watched it after you. I started texting you and was like, holy fucking shit. It was clear we had to do a mini episode on this.
So in case you haven't heard of this documentary, I am going to read the summary that is posted on HBO.com. Unfolding over 3 days of intense heat and nonstop performances, Woodstock 99, Peace, Love, and Rage examines how the festival eventually collapsed under the weight of its own misguided ambition and resulted in a grim outcome, earning the event the infamous distinction of, quote, the day the 90s died. The documentary focuses a spotlight on American youth at the end of the millennium, in the shadow of Columbine and the looming hysteria of Y2K, pinpointing a moment in time when the angst of a generation galvanized into a seismic cultural shift. Set to the soundtrack of the era's most aggressive rock bands and some rap and DJs, because we have fucking Moby in this, the film also reappraises the 1960s mythos, revealing hard truths about the dangers of the rose-tinted nostalgia in the age of commercialism and bottom-line profits. I would say some of the other music docs that are going to come out of this music box series, though, sound incredible. We have Jagged, which is about Alanis Morissette and Jagged Little Pill. There's an untitled DMX movie that follows him in like his at the final years of his life, which looks so good. There's also a Kenny G, just fascinating. Just this curly haired man playing not a clarinet, but I always call it a clarinet.
Alto sax.
Thank you. And then Mr. Saturday Night about Robert Stigwood, who created the disco era, essentially. So there are a bunch of good ones to come, but we are going to focus on this one, which we've kind of covered in some aspects what this documentary covers, which are honestly the parts that I liked the least, right? Like, I didn't care about the Y2K stuff. We did a whole Y2K episode, but even before that, what I didn't understand sometimes what this documentary was doing, who is this documentary for? Like, who do you think is going to watch it? Because if you think anybody under the age of 35 doesn't understand, that's going to watch this, doesn't understand the cultural context, like, you're kind of like talking down to your audience a little bit. And then the people who lived through it, they also clearly remember.
It is interesting. I will say this, and we've talked about it before, is that the difference between our generation and our knowledge of like previous generations' music history, can be attributed to things like I love the 80s, I love the 90s. Like, I think that there's so many pop culture touchstones that even if we ourselves didn't live through them because we are not Gen X or older, we fully understand the magnitude of the way that I don't think Gen Z quite understands. So I do wonder if this is who they were trying to target ultimately by bringing up all these other like pop culture historic events happening simultaneously. But on the other hand, I also feel like Gen Z be even interested in this documentary?
Right.
Yeah. I think you bring up a very valid point.
I think, you know, just to sort of get the negatives off the top after saying that I really enjoyed this, I would have liked to have seen a more close parallel with Woodstock 69 to 99, because they both sort of have some interesting parallels that we have since romanticized from the 60s, but we didn't do that in the 90s. And I kind of wanted some more of that versus like, oh, and then we were moving away from CDs because of Napster. I'm like, do you think any fucking Gen Z person gives a shit about fucking Napster? Move on. Like, yes, we all remember Napster. We all illegally downloaded stuff, which, by the way, I think my absolute favorite moment was Dave Mustaine being like, yeah, does Lars need more money? I don't know. I'm not going to call him an asshole, but he's kind of an asshole, right? And then he just cackles. It was so good.
Mustaine, 40 years later, still so salty about everything and ready to shit on Metallica whenever, be it the behind the music on Megadeth or Metallica.
It's specifically Lars. He just shits on Lars anytime somebody turns a camera on. He's like, have I told you that I hate fucking Lars Ulrich?
Which I can appreciate, like, of all the members, sure. But
of us shit on. Like, I feel like he just collectively gets shat on, and he fucking deserves it because he's just a dick. But I found I howled that. And then the other moment with Dexter Noodles from The Offspring, where was like, yeah, we played a place in Germany that was like built by Nazis, and that felt more welcoming than Woodstock 99. And then they both looked at each other and then cackled as well. I'm just like, oh my God, these guys are all losing it. They're like, oh, I get to dump on something. Can't wait. I got all these jokes. Been waiting.
That was probably one of the highlights of that documentary, not in a great way, but in giving you context of just how horribly organized this was and how shitty of a venue. And I think I didn't quite realize, I knew it had been in Rome because I drove a lot. Rome, New York. Sorry. Should clarify the other Rome.
No, not that Rome.
Not that Rome. Not Rome by the B-52s, but Rome, New York.
Oh my God.
I drove a lot through upstate New York as a kid going up to Vermont, where I spent part of my summer. So I was very familiar of like Bethel, where the original Woodstock was, and various other things like that. I just didn't realize it was on a former Air Force base where people
that
were
was
just
an
like,
interesting
on
wrinkle,
hot
huh?
Asphalt.
Like that's like so not a welcoming vibe.
It not feels open more.
I mean, honestly, when they first started showing shots of the Air Force Base that they would turn into Woodstock, I was like, this looks like a set from The Walking Dead.
Yes.
This looks like a prison they have to clear in order to make it habitable in the apocalypse.
And instead, they filled it with 400,000 drunk, high 20-somethings.
Okay, so I think that's the thing that really took me aback, that I really wish they did maybe a little bit more comparison to like other festivals. 350,000, 400,000 people is fucking crazy. Like, I don't even think that Coachella doesn't even that insane.
No.
That to me, that right there is like the entire problem that you're about to have. I mean, fuck all the logistics obviously were trash, like just getting any old white guy to be security, quote unquote. All they had to do was like, essentially pass like what you know when you have too many points in your driver's license and you have to go to driver school and there's like some improv person trying to teach you how to like be a better driver. That's where those people went. They went to like Hollywood driving and security school and they passed a written test after 45 seconds and then they just fucked off on their job. They only had one earnest security guard who was like, yeah, it was bad, like almost immediately, which was every single person's reaction except the two absolutely psychotic festival promoter guys.
Michael Lang and John Scher. Like, go fuck yourself. My God. I was just floored. And I was like, man, this can't get any worse. And
then it does.
It really does. They really like continue to dig the hole that they have, you know, put themselves in. And it's just a shithole. It's a dug up. They've dug the hole, filled it with all the shit from the porta potties from Woodstock 99. And then they just keep digging and filling it with more shit. Like, that's how it felt every time they were on screen.
You're like, wow, a different circle of hell I thought we had already passed on the way down. I mean, it's like first they have, I guess, semi-decent intentions. But as it goes on and things start to backfire, it's like, okay, instead of like listening to people, let's attack journalists. Okay, let's blame women for being sexually assaulted. Okay, let's blame Fred Durst for the porta potties, which are, you know, sort of like at the crux of the angst of some of this stuff. Let's blame, like, the idea that you could even give Fred Durst that much power is fucking crazy to me.
Yes.
Durst, I'm sorry, is not the problem. And then that weird baby-faced man whose idea it was to put on Woodstock, that man is so unsettling.
No, it is very unsettling. I think you're right. Giving Fred Durst that much power is really the problem here. And I mean, that's a constant The constant theme of 1999, though, really is giving
Fred Durst too much power.
Because we gave him too much power on MTV. We gave him too much power in so many other ways. And then also, like, it was, you know, Limp Bizkit and a bunch of other bands that were blamed for, like, Columbine and stuff. We ultimately were giving these bands way too much power in actually thinking that they're the ones who are going to shape the youth. I mean, it's its own version of Satanic Panic from the, like, late 90s at that point.
Yeah, except it's panic over, like, honestly, shitty rap rock. And I say that as somebody who owned not both Limp Bizkit albums, multiple Korn albums. I mean, let's just talk about this lineup to sort of set the stage, so to speak. On Friday, who would we – oh, my God, Mo makes a comeback. Because if you could cast your mind back to January 2020 – back when we had no reason to believe anything wouldn't go our way, we did a Coachella 99 lineup versus the lineup that I don't even know what Coachella's lineup's going to fucking look like, or if they're even going to do it next year. Like, that's just its own separate mess. But we were highlighting sort of like the differences between the two. And Moe, period, comes up on both fucking lineups and here at Woodstock 99.
People love jam bands, man. There are so many jam bands on this lineup, or jam band adjacent bands on here.
Well, G-Love and Special Sauce, definitely that. But I mean, we've got Lit on Friday, which another band whose album I owned. Buck Cherry, which is also crazy.
That's what we call butt rock. That they're like prototype butt rock. Like, they're a pre-Nickelback, in my opinion.
Oh, butt rock? Well, I mean, I guess that falls in line with the Creed of it all here as well.
Yeah. Creed's definitely prototype butt rock too, in this sense. Like, there's a lot of this here that gives way to, like, Nickelback, Hinder, like all these bands in the mid-2000s.
Get out of here.
Yeah. On the lips of an angel.
Well, we've got Live as well. Speaking of more butt rock, as I continue to use the phrase, I feel more comfortable with it. We also got the Roots, Insane Clown Posse, who are retiring soon. George Clinton and the people. Yeah, did you not hear that? I think it's Crazy J or Homicidal J or whatever.
You mean Violent J and Shaggy? Violent J. Shaggy Too Dope. Why do I know this? Why do I know this?
For the same reason that I kept, like, recalling, like, the dumbest pop culture shit, but could not do a math problem to save my life. We have the same brain worms, you know? That's why we have this podcast. But yeah, Violent J, don't love that name. He's got, like, heart stuff. And so he's retiring from tour life. So I think they're doing their last gathering of the Juggalos this year or something.
Oh, God.
But don't quote me. I'm not a Juggalo spokesperson.
You mean a Juggalette?
Yes. My husband just told me this information in passing because he's like, yeah, you want to know stuff about pop culture? It's like, not that. Please don't tell me stuff like this. Anyway, we also have Offspring, Korn, Bush, Sheryl Crow. They talk about this a lot, about how there is a token woman on each day of the lineup. And it's Sheryl Crow, Jewel, and Alanis Morissette are the token women that are spread out on Friday, Saturday, Sunday. The DMX sequence. Can we talk about that? Like,
yes. Seeing a lot of white people. Go ahead.
It was actually incredibly disturbing to watch. It was like, it's like worse than watching like old footage of like a Klan meeting. DMX is singing, I'm blanking on the song, but when he holds out the mic for the chorus, in which he raps the N-word, a sea of white people shout it back. And of course, you know, it's DMX. It is, you know, slightly elevated rap. Like, he's rapping about like real shit, like sad shit, angry shit. And he like really, I mean, these are things that have happened to him. So he's very like emotional. It's part of why we loved DMX. May he rest. But he is holding up the mic and he's like, you know, one of the five black people who will be performing today, and a sea of white people, a sea of like white college kids. There's something about that that's kind of like terrifying too. All feeling so comfortable.
100%.
And I mean, and like, let's talk about the 400,000 people who are, let's just say 250,000 of them are white people screaming the N-word all in unison at this concert. It's just like, in 1999, like, it was like 20 fucking years ago. That's not very long. Like, the fact that I guess as a white person, it is my privilege to be shocked by an image like that. But it's also like baseline very disturbing. And it's not like it, I haven't seen that shit before. Like, I remember very clearly being at a Jay-Z show and just a group like of 15 wasted as fuck frat boys with their like flipped up polos, like screaming the N-word. I was just like, I gotta walk away from, I can't be anywhere near this. Like, I don't like it. And like, if it was that magnified times 1 million. So that was truly one of the most disturbing scenes. I mean, obviously, apart from all the sexual assault, which was
right.
like the casual sexual assault, just so casual. And they all tried to blame it on Girls Gone Wild. And once again, to give Joe Francis any credit at all is, and especially this much power in the conversation, is bananas.
Absolutely bananas. And I think what kind of saddens me the most is just how, yeah, how trivialized it was. Like how ultimately, you know, you hear these heartbreaking things, like they interviewed that guy who was an EMT at the time and is now, and he's talking
about-
The
guy who called it a worse disaster than Katrina?
There was, I think there was him, or there was one guy who told the story about, you know, a woman wearing like another man, another EMT's clothes.
It was that guy. It was the disaster guy who was like, I've been an EMT. And he said it was like worse than Katrina and worse than a different terrible hurricane.
Yeah. And that was like, for me, I think I remember hearing like how bad this was because like, I've told you this story. I was at summer camp that summer of Woodstock 99 in Quebec because my dad wanted us to get in touch with our French Canadian roots. And one of our counselors went for the week and came back after that weekend and like, was just like, yeah, I mean, it was fun, but there was no water. It was terrible, peeing everywhere. And like, I remember her with her like French Canadian accent, like, show us your teats. Like, this was, and it's amazing how like 11-year-old Emily remembers, like 33-year-old Emily remembers this 22 years later. That this, and watching the doc like just confirmed it, because that was just the constant thing that was being chanted by these douchebags if they weren't chanting the N-word or something like that. Like, it was just the amount of white male, you know, the song like Melissa Villaseñor sings in SNL about white male rage, like this encapsulates that. It was, I think I knew that it was bad. I just, this footage, the way, you know, you see just how bad it was and what was just like casually passed on as boys being boys was fucking outrageous.
I mean, boys being boys, they literally ripped down a whole fucking wall.
Yes.
They destroyed porta potties. I mean, speaking of, you know, $8 water or whatever, they pried open food supply trucks, emptied them out, and then burned everything inside. And then they cut to that interview with one of the guys that was like maybe part of like a group of friends. I forget which. Let's talk about that one group of friends that lost their friend and they had they had all those ominous diary entries. We can talk about that in a second. But that one white guy who was like, yeah, I was like really surprised at myself that I really could just like feel all of this rage and anger. And I just started smashing things and I started just like lighting a fire. And if I saw a photo of myself, I would be like, that's not me. And how many fucking men have said that about casually sexually assaulting a woman or just doing anything
like
that's destructive?
Some sort of an existential, like out of body experience. I'm like, yeah, you say that when you're like at a concert or something weird happens.
Or if you're high.
Or you're high. You don't say that to fucking justify destruction of property or raping someone. Like, what the fuck?
I mean, there are some dudes that seemed downright terrifying. And like you were saying, I mean, not directly to your camp counselor, but about the guys saying, show us your tits, that were like a literally a wall of men sitting up there and just chanting at every single woman who walked by. And yes, it was this pseudo third wave feminism of like, I mean, I hate to use this phrase that we were just bemoaning before we started recording, but like, my body, my choice. If I wanted my tits out, like, that's my prerogative, blah, blah, blah. I just wish that everybody used enough sunscreen, but very clearly they did not because there were some sunburns.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But we're in this like pseudo third wave feminism and these men are behaving like absolute monsters. And as somebody points out, they're like, this is like the first generation of men who were raised by single working moms. Like, yeah, you know, they should be or should have more respect and like would generally have perhaps. It was a very Lord of the Flies, I think. It was like some mob hive brain mentality that like makes you forget that like women are people or something, or maybe that's just how men always are.
There is something interesting about that. You bring this up. You brought up that point, that part in the documentary where they talked about, yeah, the first generation of men raised by working mothers and that kind of thing, and mothers who are feminists. And it's interesting because we're talking about a spectrum of Gen X, you know, which was Woodstock 92, and like very pure Gen X. And then, and then Woodstock 99 being the tail end of Gen X, and then the beginning of millennials, or what they call like exennials. Like there's this, it's an interesting thing because Woodstock 99 kind of covers two different generations, like the tail end of Gen X and then the beginning of Gen Y.
It was so interesting to see footage from Woodstock 92. I feel so disconnected from just Woodstock stuff in general, just because it was not anything my parents attended or cared about, or it maybe was like also regional, but it was not something that I was like overly familiar with other than like, oh, it's a music festival, like, you know, super basic shit. But
yeah,
Woodstock 92 seemed quite nice. Like, yeah. But also I think the venue is really what set like the tone.
Totally.
I don't think, and I hate to be that person, but I don't think that like an army base has the same good vibes as like a grassy field.
Yep.
You know, they want to chalk it up to like it just being, I mean, I think it is obviously a generational divide in some ways, but in other ways, I feel like it was just set up completely different. And I don't understand, I mean, other than money, what the motivation was to do things honestly completely opposite than what you guys have ever done. Like the lineup is completely different. Like they created the environment with like really aggressive quote unquote bands. Like we've got like Limp Bizkit and Korn and like really like deep in your feelings. I mean, we also have fucking Aerosmith. So that's pretty mainstream. And you've got like James Brown, which was truly shocking to see. I was like, what? He agreed to do this? I did not understand that, but
they kept bringing that up. And I know James Brown didn't perform at Woodstock, but they brought that up a lot, that there was this emphasis on trying to connect Woodstock 69 to Woodstock 99. So which band brought on one of the members of the Doors?
It was Bush. Because I think they cut to someone from Bush being like, they were like, we were so disappointed that like nobody knew.
It was Creed.
Okay. And then I believe it was Wyclef Jean, also a strange choice for Woodstock 99, just saying. And he set his guitar on fire like Jimi Hendrix did at Woodstock 69. And all these kids were like, whatever, don't care. Like, I think one of the white guys that they interviewed was like, yeah, I had no idea who the fuck Robbie Krieger was. And like, I didn't really give a shit. I just wanted them to like play some music. And I think another thing that they did that was, I mean, I understand that Bonnaroo does something to this extent, but Woodstock 99 went 24 hours a day.
Yeah, which is wild. Like there is a level of this where I think if you're going to attempt to do that, there's a reason why Coachella has continued on, you know, 20 plus years later, and Woodstock has not. And that is just, you know, pure organization. And they talk about this in the doc too. It's just like, the contrast in levels of organization with like Coachella deciding to do it in Indio, the decision to do it in a field, like all these decisions were made. And from a logistics standpoint, yeah, they might even do a 24-hour show almost, but it's understood that like things wind down. You're going to stick to maybe one stage at one point. And like, there's just so much more thought put into this versus like, I think what's interesting to me is the number of people who organized Woodstock 99 that were just volunteers, just like pick up someone off the side of the road. Oh, guess you can be a person in charge of security.
I mean, thank God they actually had like real EMTs and real medics they're, like you said, they're on asphalt, they're on concrete, and it is over 100 degrees every single day. There's no fucking shade. Like, put up a pop tent, for crying out loud. And so it really is a miracle that they had real EMTs because people were having heat stroke, which I also didn't know that you could get so hot you get hypothermia, which was very interesting.
That was one that interested me a lot as well. I was super shocked because I like could not believe that that was a thing. I knew, my assumption was if not hypothermia when you're cold, then heat stroke when you're hot. But yeah.
Same. Yeah, because, well, like we were, like I had mentioned a little bit ago, there are lots of elements to this documentary. So it is dynamic, which I really appreciate. It's not just like a bunch of talking heads. They have like a good mixture of all different kinds of stories happening, but they have this one, well, there are a couple of tragedy storylines, but they have like one where they actually have the friends that were a part of this group that all went to Woodstock 99 together, you know, post-college, whatever. And they went with a friend who, I mean, and you have to camp there and you have to, where were they camping? Like, where was there grass to camp? Like, it just, everything looked so hard and uncomfortable and hot and shitty. And your fucking hot ass tent that has no shade all day that you go and sleep in. And then you have people who are like super fucked up banging on trash cans all night. Anyway, they travel with a friend who keeps a diary talking, and they have someone in voiceover reading his entries, talking about what shows he saw, whatever. At some point, they get separated from him because he wants to see Metallica and he wants to get to the front to watch them. And, you know, in a sea of 400,000 fucking people, which is crazy, 400,000 people pre-cell phones. And the way that you could find somebody, which I thought was like cute maybe like in theory, but like in practice would probably give me so much anxiety. There's like a people matcher finder misconnections wall where you leave notes for your friends because there's so many fucking people. You can't find them on your own. You have to like meet up at this designated area like you're in Disneyland and you're a lost 7-year-old.
Do you know the scene in The Lion King where there's the antelope stampede? That is what I felt as I was watching this happen and imagining what it would be like to lose someone without a cell phone in pre-cell phone times in a 400,000 person open fucking field.
Open former Air Force base. Like former, so yes, much worse. Yes.
Field.
Although, like at just, least yeah. in a I was going to say, yeah. At least in a field, like slightly pleasant, but yeah. It's the sea of people. 400,000 people is literally unfucking manageable. That's a city. Like,
yeah.
You guys didn't build a functional city. This isn't Sims. But anyway, they lose their friend. He gets caught in Metallica. He gets hypothermia. When he goes to the nurse's station, they misdiagnose what's wrong with him. And they think he has like a heart attack or is having a heat stroke or something. And so they use the paddles on him and that actually gives him a heart attack and he dies. And his friends can't find him for like a day and a half, which like hearing them talk about it. And then when that guy started crying, I started crying. Like, this is like your worst fucking nightmare. Too. And they find out dude is dead. And then they're like, we have to call his parents. It's just like, this is awful. I like worst weekend. I don't even know. Like, it was just terrible.
How do you come back from that? Like survivor guilt, like all these things. I just, and you know, deep down, we as an audience watching this know that this is, you can't blame it on a bunch of kids. Like they had no idea what was going to happen.
I blame the organizers who were so disorganized that people don't even have the time because there are so many, there are people getting sexually assaulted left and right. There are people who have actual heat stroke. Like they're spread and stretched so fucking thin. They don't have the time or the support or the resources to even ask this man a question to diagnose him properly. And that's on the organizers. That's not, I mean, it's on some of the nurses, but it's mostly on the organizers completely.
And that's where the contract with continuing, you know, to splice the interviews with the organizers, Michael Lee.
Oh my God, these two tone-deaf assholes.
I couldn't believe it. You're just hearing these heartbreaking stories about sexual assault and women just being, you know, groped and just like molested and just all these horrible things. And then you just cut to John Sherry's just been like, yeah, these women could have kept their shirts on. Like they could have done this. They could have done that. Like basically using, you know, she was asking for it. And was just unbelievable. Like I just, even watching like the Firefest documentary, at least they could own, these idiots like could own up to, you know, Billy McFarlane could at least own up to the fact that he had some fault. And I'm not saying Firefest did not have sexual assault that I know of and like the level of destruction and all that. But he could at least own up to some bit of fault, despite him being a shit person. Like, here, the fact that neither organizer would own up to a single thing being their fault was the absolute most shocking part of this, especially 20 plus years later.
I mean, the delusion on the both of them to think that they could blame women for their own sexual assault, which the woman who went to Woodstock 99 who left early and then started that like anonymous online tip, like, oh my God, she broke my heart just the way that she had described all of her interactions with people afterwards. I mean, it was so caring and sweet of her to do this, but it's also just so sad and it was terrible. And it's like so much. And, you know, she highlights like how many people didn't even report anything.
And the fact that she is the one who did this, took it in her own hands to do that and not an organizer or anyone official with the actual festival. Not that I expect them to, because they've shown their true colors and they're assholes, but like,
yeah, I mean, to believe that this walking, fucking, talking toilet scrubber has the audacity to blame other women. I mean, he blamed journalists. He blamed MTV, people that they actually wanted to be there, as if they weren't trying to fucking monetize this fucking thing through and through for every goddamn dollar they could get. Why else would you price water for fucking dollars and then not give anybody actual water? And then they're talking about this trough that people were like bathing in. I was disgusted.
I mean, people were bathing, pissing in it. Like, what, you expect people to actually want to fill their water bottles with like, water that is contaminated and could potentially give them some sort of an infection? Like, I in my 20s, I put up with a lot of shit, you know, like you put up with things and they're like things that I would never do now as a 30 something. Like, I don't see myself going to a music festival where I camp out. Like, I just don't think it's in the cards for me anymore. And that's okay. But to see the level of what these 20 somethings were dealing with, like, I'd never seen anything like this. No, certainly not in like the United States. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, I think I would have fully left. I don't think that camping out at a music festival was ever for me. I just feel like I camped out at a beer fest once, and that was more than enough. It's too many different personalities, and it's not like regular camping where, like, the expectation is to be in nature, so it's, you know, quiet. So I don't think it'll ever really be for me, but, you know, we did one day at Outside Lands, and you and I, like, fell apart on the bus ride home. You know, I think we got a day. Maybe two.
Yeah.
But I don't see it happening. I mean, especially like it shouldn't be like this. To hear our King Dave Holmes be like, yeah, you have to find pizza boxes that were still white. Why do they need to still be white, Dave? Oh, because that means they are not urine soaked. I'm just
Between
what the fucking shit is happening over
between
here?
Between his stories and Rob Sheffield from Rolling Stone stories, I was like, God damn. Like,
I mean, I think
shit these two have seen.
I think Carson Daly got it the fucking worst. Like, he had shit being thrown at
him. Which, by the way, he wasn't interviewed in this doc, but they put in audio clips from the Ringer's 8-part podcast series on Woodstock 99.
Oh, interesting. So I was like, did he just like call in?
No. So anytime they had audio in there, it was from that. And I actually want to listen to that podcast series now. Now that we've watched this doc and we're talking about it, I'm like, oh, I think if I, you know, have the chance, I will listen to this 8-part series. But yeah, the Ringer did that. And I believe that's where they interviewed Carson Daly and got that audio from.
Aha. So he wasn't just Skyping in at the last minute.
From the Today Show studio.
I don't know his life.
Can you imagine he's about to like talk about the latest fall fashions and has just had to talk about some harrowing story out of Woodstock 99 at 5 in the morning? Like, my God.
Well, I mean, I think speaking of other people who I wish contributed less, Moby.
Oh, God.
His whole thing about being like, yeah, you get there and like the vibes are off and like all this shit. But this motherfucker stays. Mm. He watches the show. He gets all fucking up his own ass about like, oh, it's so upsetting to see women sexually assaulted. Except he didn't fucking say shit. You know who said something? Fucking Dexter from fucking Offspring. He was the only person with any guts to be like, yo, stop being little fucking creeps right now. And then he got like shit thrown at him too. So spare me, Moby, and your fucking terrible. His tattoos are so bad. What is happening?
Out of control.
Is he having a midlife crisis? I think he's having a crisis.
He's older than that at this point. No, I think it's so, I think it's rich for someone like Moby to like harp on misogyny that was happening there when he very clearly hit on Natalie Portman when she was underage. Like, seriously, dude, like, you're one to talk. And there's a lot of this. It's like, I think revisiting at the time, you know, the men in the music world, not all of them, but a lot of them at the time who made all this, all these comments about things being homophobic and misogynist, which I agree. Like, there were plenty of acts like, fuck Kid Rock. That guy is the worst. I absolutely hate him. And like everything he said during that performance.
Except, except the dude who sadly passed away though. One of his diary entries, which these diary entries are like so comically ominous too. Yes. Because like from the first moment they're like 7/23/99 today I saw, and I was like, this dude's dead, right? Like, just come out and fucking say it.
Stop with this like dramatic.
But he talks about Kid Rock in one of his diary entries. He's like, his performance was sick or whatever he says, and he's like, he played every single instrument up there. And then they cut to the footage of Kid Rock going up there and like, you know, hitting a drum for like 3 seconds, like, and like playing every instrument,
spinning like scratching the record for 2 seconds
and like not well either. No. So like, please stop. But I forgot like what a thing he was, because he's such a joke now. To think that he had this much sway and like these many people convinced that he was like the shit was very funny.
There was a 3-year period where people took him seriously as an artist. And that is wild to me. Like, I think I've told you the story of the time my high school was the reason why the FCC fined a local radio station $60,000, because a bunch of girls from my high school called into the local radio station to be cage dancers in a Kid Rock concert and stated their credentials. So then the radio DJ proceeded to just like say all sorts of shit about my high school and how slutty the girls were. And the principal's daughter caught it on the radio. And then, they fined the FCC, or the FCC fined them. Anyway, needless to say, Kid Rock was a thing for 3 years, and that is one of our biggest tragedies as a country, and that's saying a lot.
Well, since we're talking about Kid Rock, let's just talk about this Saturday lineup really quick, because they want to blame all of these other people, but they didn't even realize, the promoters want to do that, they didn't even realize what sort of powder keg they're setting up for themselves. So the day that Kid Rock performs, we also have Wyclef Jean, The Counting Crows, Dave Matthews Band, which I love that dead guy was like, yeah, fucking Dave Matthews Band rocks. I'm like, this is, I don't know why that made me laugh.
They made a lot of people very happy people that I'm fucking friends with.
I mean, know. Honestly, these Israelis I used to work with at Meta Cafe were like, yeah, we've seen Dave Matthews Band like 12 times. I'm like, what? They're like, you want to come with us? I'm like, no, you can count me out. But Dave Matthews are some people's fish. Like, I get it. It's fine.
If you grew up on the East Coast, you may have gone to liberal arts school. The number of Dave Matthews fans that I know, and also because I grew up in Virginia and he is from Virginia, like, it is, people love them. And at one point I liked them. I now don't. I don't, you know, I don't actively listen to Dave Matthews Band.
You can like Dave Matthews Band. I'm not going to judge you. I saw him once in downtown San Francisco grabbing lunch, and he's just as short as you thought he is.
I honestly, whenever I think of Dave Matthews, I think of the bus dropping all that shit in the Chicago.
Oh my God. I just brought that up the other day. Did I say that to you? Yeah. Or did I...
No, you didn't say that to me, but I know someone who put it on in her Instagram story. She's like, what? I never knew this. I'm like, yeah, what? I only found that out recently. Yeah.
I can't remember. Someone was going, oh, Todd went to Chicago for something. And we were like, oh, is he going to visit the lake house? I'm like, oh, we should visit the part on the bridge where Dave Matthews Band dumped a bunch of like gray water into the canal. And everybody looked at me and I was like, wait, you guys didn't hear that story? Everyone's like, what the no fuck are you knows. Talking about?
I'm like, the people gotta know.
Now we know. Yeah. Now we said it. Anyway, so after Dave Matthews Band, though, is Alanis Morissette, which looked like to be the last peaceful moment, because then we go into Limp Bizkit, Rage Against the Machine, and Metallica. So they say they don't want to promote like violence or whatever. And I'm not saying that these bands do that. I'm just saying that they are a different type of band where if you've already got an agitated crowd who's ready to fuck shit up, this is the soundtrack that you fuck shit up to. I don't know, like, you're Spider-Man pointing at himself in the mirror. Like, I don't really know what you guys thought you were fucking doing. But then they, I guess it's like on, was it on the Sunday that they set fire to everything? And then they had Red Hot Chili Peppers come out and like sing to calm the crowd, but it didn't do anything.
Well, they sang Fire by Jimi Hendrix. Like that was, so they told the Red Hot Chili
and
Peppers
Flea,
on Sunday. Yeah.
And Flea is fully fucking naked. Honestly, this doc, I saw a lot of boobs, but also I saw way too many dicks and I was not
so
happy.
So many penises.
Did not need to see that many. If I wanted to see that, I'd just go to the Castro and sit outside.
You make the choice there.
I am choosing. And I was just every time I'm like, ugh, and they were, and it was always accompanied by like a terrible, aggressive sunburn. That's right. Why I was like, everything about this is upsetting.
It was just like pale penis, very red, rest of body.
Oh God, what an awful phrase.
Oh God. So do we have any other things that, you know, we want to cover on this episode? Anything that we missed talking about?
I think for not really taking notes, we did quite well.
I think so too.
But we'll definitely come back and probably do a few more recaps as they come out. Whatever they do come out. It says starting in late fall, and the first one's going to be Jagged after Woodstock 99, so you know we're going to talk about that.
Best believe.
But we also have a lot of other things we are going to be talking about because our new season 6, launches very soon, September 16th to be exact. And if you want to stay on top of that and any other minis that we are recording and releasing, you want to make sure that you are subscribed to this podcast feed. And you can subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen, whether that be iTunes. Well, it's not even iTunes now. It's like Apple Podcasts, I guess.
Yeah.
Spotify, Amazon, Stitcher, etc. You can also keep up with us by following us on Instagram and or Facebook. We're at The Old Millennials Pod. And if you want to keep up with us individually, you can find Emily and I on Twitter. I am at Marg, she wrote.
And I'm at Emily A. Bejean.
And until next time, we say bye.
Bye.